I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today we talk about books on whales. Joining us, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Dennis Minsky, field biologist, and he's the naturalist and marine educator aboard the Dolphin Whale Watch Fleet. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Mindy. Good morning, Jill.
And of course, this is, you know, Moby Dick, you're always talking Moby Dick, Jill, so talking about a show of books on whales, and you didn't bring Moby Dick.
Well, and I'm sort of shocked that Dennis didn't bring, I was counting on Dennis to bring Moby Dick, but although I do think during the course of this show, as has already happened, we will be talking about Moby Dick from time to time.
I would simply say that Moby Dick deserves its own show. Mm-hmm. We could spend a whole hour talking about we'd spend many hours, but I do want to just mention that Provincetown Library, our great librarian, Matt Clark, local historian Stephen Burkowski, and Laura Ludwig from the Center for Coastal Studies did cooperate and put on a Moby Dick Festival this late April, and it was wonderful, and there will be another one next year. Mm-hmm. But all I have to say about Moby Dick is read it. It's the quintessential whale book, and it's transformational. And read it with a friend, read it with a group, but it's unbelievable. That's all I'm going to say about it.
And Nat Philbrook has a book, Why Read Moby Dick?
Indeed he
highlighting
does.
All the reasons why you should read Moby Dick.
That's right. Yep. That's right.
Well, let's start with kids' books. And Jill, you brought a few, so let's get a couple of kids' books in here.
I did. And I think that this is one of the sweetest kids' books I've ever read. And I had not heard of it prior to thinking about a whaling show because it involves a whale. And I don't know how I'd miss this book because it's fabulous. It's called Amos and Boris by William Stieg. And it is a very sweet tale about a friendship between a mouse and a whale. And just to give you an idea, and what happens when the mouse, it begins, Amos, a mouse, lived by the ocean. He loved the ocean. He loved the smell of sea air. He loved to hear the surf sounds, the bursting breakers, the backwashes with rolling pebbles. And the illustrations are also done by William Stieg. So if any of you are familiar with his work, it's very sort of whimsical and lovely. And he decides he's going to go out on a boat, and he builds a boat, this little mouse. And I love this description of what he puts on the boat. When the boat was finished, he loaded it with cheese, biscuits, acorns, honey, wheat germ, 2 barrels of fresh water, a compass, a sextant, a telescope, a saw, a hammer and nails, and some wood in case repairs should be necessary, a needle and thread for the mending of torn sails, and various other necessities such as bandages and iodine, a yo-yo, and playing cards. So I thought that was a great description. In any case, there's a terrible storm when he's out at sea, and he meets the whale, and the whale is in, of course, the middle of this immense ocean, and they become fast friends. And it's a story as much about a whale and a mouse as it is certainly of friendship, and how these two become great friends, and first one saves the life of one, and then they reverse, and they have a very happy ending, I'm pleased to say.
And we'll have to read this book to find out how a mouse saves a whale.
That is correct. That is, I will leave that as one of the mysteries of this book. It's Amos and Boris by William Stieg. And another one I brought along, which I also just loved, it's called Whale Trails Before and Now by Lisa Klein Ransom and illustrated by G. Brian Karras. And they've done something really interesting in this book. They've taken the business of going out on a whaling tour to see whales, the modern whaling tour, and against every image of what's happening on the present day whaling trip, they have next to it illustration sort of in a black and white feeling to it. They're, both sets of illustrations are very different. And in that set, it's about what they would have done on a whaling boat if they were whalers, as opposed to what happens when you go out on a whaling ship. to see them. And it's very sweet. And it's it is all told through the eyes of the young girl whose father runs this whaling trips. And the illustrations are lovely. And it really talks about how the great differences between what happened then and what happened now. So it's a little history lesson, but it also really makes kids, I think, appreciate the majesty of whales and the fun of going out to see them.
Right. And Dennis, you have a young adult book there for us?
Yes. They call it a book for young readers. It's called Ice Whale. The author is Jean Craighead George, which you probably know.
She is a classic, yes.
My Side of the Mountain and so on. Interesting side note, Jean Craighead George had twin brothers, the Craigheads, who spent their entire lives studying grizzly bears in Yellowstone. At any rate, she is a nature writer for young readers. Jean Craighead George died before she finished this book. This is her last book. It was taken over by her children, one of whom has a PhD in cetology and in whale biology and studies bowhead whales. At any rate, this book begins, and all the books I have here today are not about whales. They're about whales and people. So no field guides, no nothing. But these are all interactions of whales and people. This is fantastic. In the year 1848, a young, call him Eskimo boy, witnesses the birth of a bowhead whale. His name is Tuzak. The whale's name is Siku. For the next 200 years, yes, 200 years, there is a bond between Tuzak's people and this particular whale. Siku calls Tuzak the boy with kind eyes. And yes, bowhead whales have been documented to live over 200 years.
Wow.
So Tuzak's descendants, all the way down to his great-great-great granddaughter, who marries the son of a whaling, the great-great-great-grandson of a whaling captain, and back and forth, these people interact with this one particular bowhead whale. And the final chapter is, of course, in the future, 2048, at which time it is written that by 2048, it had been 200 years since the first Yankee whale ship sailed into the Arctic. The Western Arctic bowhead whale population had recovered its former numbers. The profitable years of oil development had diminished. Life in the Arctic community still relied on a lifestyle without whales, caribou, seals, fish, and the knowledge to hunt them. The village could not survive. Interesting to note, they hunt whales. They say that a whale offers itself to a hunter when the time is right and if the person is living a right life. At any rate, so much to learn about Arctic communities, about Arctic life, and about the real, about the bond between wildlife and humans, which is something I'm going to be coming back to throughout.
And that is called Ice Whale.
Ice Whale. It's beautiful. I'm going to hold it up to the mic. It's
a beautiful, take a look.
Beautiful book. Ice Whale, Jean Craighead George.
Jill?
I've brought along a sort of sad picture book. In fact, this is one of the saddest picture books I think I've ever read. It's called The Stranded Whale by Jane Yolen, and it is set in 1971, although it was published fairly recently, and a girl named Sally and her brothers are walking home across the sand dunes of their main town when they see, as it says in the book, this big gray thing humped on the dying sand. And what it is a beached whale, and it's a beached gray whale, and it's about how these three children try to save the whale, as does the town. And there are some beautiful illustrations in here, but it's this heartbreak that the young girl has when the whale dies. And it's a very sad story. And what happens is they get home and they're given these medals for trying to save the whale. But for her, that's not what she wanted. She wanted
the whale.
She wanted the whale to live. And as it says at the end of this book, so the whale died and we were heroes, yet somehow I was still mad. I put my medal in the drawer and never took it out again. Mm. And what's interesting is the author's note in here talks about how she began this book when she was in Scotland, but she decided to not set the story in Scotland because, in fact, as she says, there are beachings of whales everywhere. And she wanted to make it clear that she thought it was important that the whale not live, because this is what can actually happen. Because the truth, as she says, is that the majority of such strandings do end in death. But what she also decided to do was set it in a particular time before cell phones. She didn't want them to have help trying to save this whale other than the people that were there. So she says in her author's note, more important for the story, the use of modern cell phones would have brought help sooner. Possibly with modern Coast Guard techniques, the whale might have been saved. At the very least, there'd have been crews of TV reporters and photographers complicating the effort. And so she talks a little bit about why whales beach. So there's a little educational piece at the back. And she also says that she'd like to think that when my young narrator grows up, she'll be the first in her family to go to college. Perhaps she'll study marine biology working at the biological laboratory at Woods Hole in Massachusetts. She says, I visited there in the 1970s, and I think it would suit her perfectly. So a nice little shout out to the MBL as well as a very sort of moving picture book about what happens when a whale does not live. And last picture book is An Ocean World by Peter Siss. I'm not familiar if anybody's familiar with his beautiful illustrations. Peter Siss is a great illustrator. And this is, in fact, a picture book that is almost entirely pictures. And it is dedicated to all who care about our world and starts with a postcard that he writes to his family. Greetings from Ocean World. This morning I saw a whale who has been here since she was just a few weeks old, and what they're going to do is put her out to sea. And it's a telling of the tale of what happens when this whale who has been in captivity goes out. And it's actually sort of funny because a lot of the images are of other things that the whale thinks might be related to it, because it's never actually seen a whale such as itself. And so it sees things like a ship. It sees things like a boat, another fish, and all of these things, a submarine that it looks like itself, and eventually it finds a whale that looks just like it, that really is a whale. So a very sort of sweet and beautiful telling of a story of freedom and love.
With no words.
With no words, that's right. Almost 99% images. An Ocean World by Peter Siss, with beautiful illustrations.
Dennis, what's next on your list?
Well, I'll go to the not sweet, rather harsh book, A Whale for the Killing by Farley Mowat, written in 1972, also before cell phones. And it is the story, I'd forgotten what, of course he wrote Never Cry Wolf and lots of other. I forgot what a great writer he is. This is a heart-wrenching true tale of cruelty and courage about a fin whale that mistakenly enters a salt pond. It's about a half mile by a half mile after herring and becomes trapped up in Newfoundland. I'm so proud I finally learned how to pronounce Newfoundland. And it's what ensues. There is both cruelty and heroism in this. There are many men who use the whale for target practice. Mm. There are many people trying to save the whale. It's heart-wrenching, and it's all true. And again, the theme, people and whales, Mowat blames the modern lifestyle, the transformation of Newfoundland into a more industrial, away from the sea kind of place, even in the 70s, fishing gone by. he said that in the old days, they would not have treated the whale this way, that they respect a fellow hunter and so on. But I'll just read, just to give you a sample. The whale actually, they hear the whale vocalize. That whale, she spoke to we. I think she spoke to we. This is a Newfoundland. I nodded in agreement, for I will always believe she deliberately tried to span the chasm between our species, between our distant worlds. She failed, yet it was not total failure. So long as I live, I shall hear the echoes of that haunting cry, and they will remind me that life itself, not human life, is the ultimate miracle upon this earth. I will hear those echoes even if the day should come when none of her nation, he calls this the whale nation, none of her nation is left alive in the desecrated seas, and the voices of the great whales have been silenced forever. And we have to remind ourselves, this was written in 1972, he was very pessimistic about the future of whales. Remember, the moratorium on whaling wasn't until 1982, wasn't put in effect until 1986. So there was a very real possibility that whales would vanish. Mm-hmm. But it's an amazing, amazing book.
Do we see you mentioned the folks who are target practice and not so nice to the whale, and then the people trying to save the whale. Do they have confrontations with each other in the story? I would imagine so.
They do, in fact. And in fact, Farley Mowat, who comes from Ontario, but he and his wife love this little village. It's called Burgio, and they're sort of like summer people here on Cape Cod. They've adopted this place. They travel around the world. They always come back to it, the people, all of that. But when he publicizes the plight of this whale, he becomes, I'm reminded of Henrik Ibsen's An Enemy of the People, he becomes persona non grata in the town. And I'm not sure what happens, but they think they're going to have to leave. That's a sad aspect of it.
Yeah.
And there's good and bad in this. There are some really wonderful people and some really horrible people, and there's some people who are both. But it's an amazing book. Less impressive to me, but also interacting people and whales, is a whale named Grayson by Lynn Cox, recommended to me, I should say, by Liz Bradfield, whose work I've read on your show, a colleague of mine on the boat. And this is about a young woman training who finds a baby gray whale and spends the day trying to rescue it. A charming book, but doesn't have the heft of...
The first book is
A Whale for the Killing, and the second book, Grayson, is what she names this baby whale that she reunites with its mother. A little less convincing, but charming nevertheless.
You said it has a happy ending.
Yeah. Well, this book, I think the ending is happier than Mowat would have known.
Yeah.
And that's good news.
That's good news. We're talking about books on whales with Dennis Minsky, field biologist, naturalist, and marine educator aboard the Dolphin Whale Watch Fleet, and Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about books on whales with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Dennis Minsky, field biologist. He's a naturalist and marine educator aboard the Dolphin Whale Watch Fleet. And what do you've got next, Jill?
Well, always one of the great pleasures of doing this show is uncovering a book I had not seen before that is just beautiful. And this is no exception. This book is called Treasures of the Whaling Museum, Touchstones to the Region's Past. And it is a collection of all the things that one might find going to the Whaling Museum, the New Bedford Whaling Museum. And it was done by the Old Dartmouth Historical Society and the New Bedford Whaling Museum just last year. This was published in 2015. It is filled with beautiful images from their collections, and it talks about what it's illustrating. It says in the introduction, the book both illustrates and discusses the museum's greatest treasures. Highlights include the world's largest and most important library of whaling logbooks, journals, manuscripts, and prints housed in the Wattles Jacobs Education Center, and the superlative collection of 19th century New Bedford painters, among them William Bradford, Albert Bierstadt, and Robin Swain Gifford. Mm. The Scrimshaw collection is by far the most complete in existence. The collections of Japanese whaling art and literature and Dutch Old Master whaling paintings are the most comprehensive in the New World. So it has beautiful images in this book, and it also gives you a little bit of history about every object that they illustrate. And one of the things they have in here is a big chapter on Scrimshaw, and it is just really interesting to see some of the things that were made out of Scrimshaw. In this chapter, they have something called assorted fist canes, and fist canes are canes, apparently, in which the top of the cane is in the shape of a fist and is made out of Scrimshaw. And they have a huge collection of pictures of these incredible canes, which are really beautiful. And they have all kinds of boxes and a little history about how this came to be and who was doing it first. And the first known American Scrimshaw artist was a fellow named Edward Burdett, as it happens. Mm. And he was supposedly one of the best. And he began carving Scrimshaw about 1824. Mm. And it was, in fact, they were doing Scrimshaw other places prior to here, but the first American Scrimshaw artist. And they have great illustrations, and they've done a beautiful job of highlighting all their collections, some big double spreads of the paintings that are hanging in their on their walls. So I urge you both to go to the museum.
I say, what a great way to inspire you to go see this
exactly
stuff in person, right?
Exactly, right.
Well, the other thing too, is the logbooks. Those mm-hmm. are really eye-opening when you
and
you get to look at
absolutely,
some of
and
the
they
whale
are
digital,
yeah. Right? And they are now digitizing those logbooks, so there you can read a lot of them online now. They're really fascinating.
Yeah. Dennis, what's your next book?
My next book is a delightful book called "The Moon by Whale Light." Yes, you heard me right. "The Moon by Whale Light." The author is Diane Ackerman, and she's a poet. She's also writes prose. She wrote a book called The Natural History of the Senses, which is an excellent book. And in this book, subtitle, Other Adventures Among Bats, Penguins, Crocodiles, and Whales. In each chapter, she features a biologist who is focused on these whales and on these animals. And the whale chapter is about Roger Payne, who's a most delightful man from Massachusetts, who is pretty much associated with the Song of the Humpback Whale. He's the first. Mm-hmm. He and Scott McVeigh from Mass Audubon, I don't know if they first discovered it, but he pretty
brought
much
it to our attention for
exactly.
sure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he's a delightful guy. Half this section of the book deals with him in Hawaii and whale singing, and the other half down in Patagonia, where he goes, where he has a research station. He's just a delightful man, and lots of great biology in here. I can tell you that this is a South Atlantic right whale, not our right whale, but they come up from the Arctic and they breed there, and then they actually sail across this bay with their tail. They put their tail up and sail across. They get sunburn and the gulls come down and peel their skin off.
Is that right?
Something I thought was really interesting, and I don't know if...
I didn't know they got sunburned.
So
I had no idea.
So here's sort of an R-rated section to this.
Warning, R-rated.
In right whales, you have a very curious thing. The testes of a male blue whale, the largest whale in the world, weigh about 70 kilos, 154 pounds.
Wow.
That's for a 180-foot animal. You might ask, what do the testes of the male right whale weigh, since it's a much smaller animal? The answer is 1 metric ton, 2,200 pounds.
What?
The largest testes ever recorded in any animal. This is what's so great about studying. So why the difference? Because the right whale is a sexier animal. Yeah. There are multiple matings.
Yeah.
The blue whale, presumably, is much more, if not...
Monogamous.
Mm-hmm. It's more sedate. Mm-hmm. But right whale mating, and those of you who've seen it from the shore...
If you've been on the right whales, if you've been out on the whale things, yeah, you see them out there frolicking around with a number of whales.
It's multiple males, and it's the... And it's sperm competition, basically what it is. So the more you make, the better your chances.
Wow. But who would have thought, right?
But who would have thought? 2,200 pounds. Yeah. I mean, that's...
And is that true for our right whale as well?
I'm sure it is, because they do the same behavior.
Yeah. Wow, that's fascinating.
But there are a lot of facts like that. I just picked the sexiest one. But here's another. Roger Payne just sounds like such a wonderful guy. I think he's still alive. I haven't heard otherwise.
He's been here on the show. Yeah. It's been years. But yeah, he is really interesting. You're right.
He say, "We may be the biggest flop ever came on Earth. People often wonder just how intelligent whales are. But I could argue that there is no intelligent life on Earth. That all we do with our brains is commit a series of the greatest mistakes, that the human brain is the most unsuccessful adaptation ever to appear in the history of life on Earth. Neanderthal man only lasted for maybe 75,000 years. We've lasted about a fifth of that time. What are the chances we'll last another 50,000 years? Whales have an important lesson to teach us. Whales have a large and complex brain, but show no signs of threatening their own destruction. They haven't reproduced themselves into oblivion. They haven't destroyed the resources upon which they depend. They haven't generated giant holes in the ozone or increased the Earth's temperature, on and on and on.
Yeah.
So it's just another way of looking at things.
His work with the whale sounds, I mean, you know, really brought those beautiful sounds to us. I mean,
yeah, he's a musician too. Yeah, he plays music and... Anyhow, so this is another great book.
And that's The Moon by
Whale. The Moon by Whale Light by Diane Ackerman. She reminds me of my friend Philip Hoare, whose books I'm
great,
also not mentioning today. I guess I just did mention
them.
But I've talked about them on the last two shows.
All right.
The Sea Inside and Or the Whale. Lots of great stuff
he's
about
definitely
whales.
Worth reading as well.
Yeah, but she reminds me of him.
Okay. Jill.
Well, and I thought I'd bring a couple of poets with me as well. And of course, we have to mention Moby Dick again, because that's what the poets are most interested in is Moby Dick. And I've brought along a book called A Whaler's Dictionary by Dan Beachy Quick. And it's a very interesting thing that he has tried to do here. And he has in his introduction, because this is a very poetic book. It is also a deeply thoughtful book about whales and specifically about Moby Dick. And in his introduction, which he calls Introduction or How to Use This Book, and you know, any book that comes with a book with an intro trying to tell you how to use it, you know, you might want to hesitate unless you're a sort of person that likes that sort of thing. And what he writes in this beginning is, he says, submerged within Moby Dick lurks an unfinished dictionary specific to the science and art of whaling. As Ishmael's dictionary was meant to allow a whaler to know what kind of beast he was chasing, so a whaler's dictionary's highest hope is simply to allow a reader to gain a greater sight of what this Leviathan Moby Dick itself might be, and in doing so, encourage a closer reading. As Ishmael's dictionary let a whaler name his danger, a whaler's dictionary offers a series of interlaced meditations to bring a reader nearer to the white squall of meaning that is Moby Dick. And then he goes on to tell you how you're supposed to read his book. And he says some words of advice and warning. A whaler's dictionary is not meant to be read from first page to last. This dictionary is not concerned with sequence so much as consequence. A reader is encouraged to thumb through the book until an entry seems of interest. And then at the bottom of each of his entries, so I was, you know, taking him at his word and sort of going, flipping through this. And indeed, at the bottom of every, so for example, there's a section called inspiration, and then it says see also brain, breath, classification, definition, line, Orpheus. These are all various other entries that he has. They're like sort of mini essays on Moby Dick, each and every one. And he has some extraordinary thoughts about how things connect. This, for example, he has this whole section on letters, and he writes, there are curious parallels between the nature of whaling and the nature of the letter. A whale must be cut to become a prophet. An envelope must be pierced for its content to be read. And he goes on from there. So he's a very thoughtful guy and a very beautiful writer. And if you just want to dip in and out and learn a little bit more about Moby Dick and about language, because this is as much about language as anything, A Whaler's Dictionary by Dan Beachy Quick.
That's a great gift for somebody who's a Moby Dick fan.
It absolutely is.
Yeah. And you said you had another poetry book?
I do have another poetry
book. Yeah, I just add that Philbrick said about Moby Dick, in its flights of language, Moby Dick can be more like a little intimidating, as if Shakespeare and the translators of the King James Bible teamed up to write a very weird book about whaling.
That's great. So, absolutely.
That's what you need that book for.
That is absolutely right.
I'm going to get that one.
And I did have to, I felt it necessary to bring, and I'm surprised, Dennis, you did not bring this with you, but I'm sure you've read this. It is a poem called The Wellfleet Whale by Stanley Kunitz. And I won't read, it's a long poem. I won't read the whole poem, but he does have a journal entry about why he wrote this poem. And he writes, a few summers ago on Cape Cod, a whale foundered on the beach, a 63-foot finback whale. When the tide went out, I approached him. He was lying there in monstrous desolation, making the most terrifying noises, rumbling, groaning. I put my hands on his flanks, and I could feel the life inside him. And while I was standing there, suddenly he opened his eye. Mm. It was a big, red, cold eye, and it was staring directly at me. A shudder of recognition passed between us. Then the eye closed forever. I've been thinking about whales ever since.
Oh my goodness.
And this is indeed about the Wellfleet Whale, a little bit of it.
Yeah.
And it's done in sections. So this is from section 3. An afternoon you swam tirelessly round the bay with such an easy motion, the slightest downbeat of your tail, an almost imperceptible undulation of your flippers. You seem like something poured, not driven. You seem to marry grace with power. And when you bounded into air, slapping your flukes, we thrilled to look upon pure energy incarnate as nobility of form. You seemed to ask of us not sympathy or love or understanding, but awe and wonder. That night, we watched you swimming in the moon. Your back was molten silver. We guessed your silent passage by the phosphorescence in your wake. At dawn, we found you stranded on the rocks.
Mm. Mm.
And it goes on from there. Yeah. But beautiful poem and a Wellfleet whale.
And we are talking about books on whales with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Dennis Minsky, field biologist and naturalist and marine educator aboard the Dolphin Whale Watch Fleet. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about books on whales with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Dennis Minsky, field biologist and naturalist and marine educator aboard the Dolphin Whale Watch Fleet. And Jill, what's your next book up?
Well, I do have one other Moby-related book, of course. And this one is called Moby Dick in Pictures, One Drawing for Every Page by Matt Kish. This actually began as a blog. This guy got this idea that he was going to take and one edition of Moby Dick, and every day he was going to do an illustration based on whichever page he was reading that day.
Hmm.
So inside this book, there are, in fact, and he succeeded in doing this, and somebody decided that it was time for the blog to become a book, as happens often these days. And there are 552 illustrations in this book, one for each page that he read. And he was doing these live, you know, so he was posting them live. But looking at them as a group, there are many, many whale illustrations within his, not surprisingly, a lot of ocean, beautiful ocean images. And he's done a lot of sort of found images. He takes various kinds of paper and puts them all together, and everything. He was very concerned about not doing anything digitally. This was really actually what he was creating. And as it turns out, he's also a librarian, which I did not know until I was reading this book. And he has a little quote from Moby Dick on each page, which was the piece that convinced him to do that illustration that day. It was a remarkable effort on his behalf. And the illustrations are really interesting. And again, it's a way to dive into Moby Dick. If you have never read it, start here and get inspired to read it.
Did you say he did these in a day?
Every day he did another one.
So this, looking at some of these, you can't believe you finished that in a day.
Right, exactly.
Wow.
Yes. So he was a busy guy.
Sure was.
And it's a beautiful book. And then at the end, it's funny because the last page is read the classic novel that inspired Moby Dick in pictures. And so they have the very edition that he used when he was doing this. And he had been, as many people are, possessed by Moby Dick for many, many, many years before he took this on.
Okay, Moby Dick in...
Moby Dick in pictures, one drawing for every page by Matt Kish.
And that reminds me that Philip Hoare did Moby Dick, the Big Read online. It's MobyDickBigRead.com or something like that. And each chapter has a piece of art. And each chapter is read by a different person. Call Me Ishmael, the first chapter is Tilda Swinton. David Cameron, David Attenborough, John Waters, Dennis Minsky, Mary Oliver, on and on. But there's a lot of art in that, too, if you go to MobyDickBigRead.com, I think it is. But, yeah, it calls for art, Moby Dick does.
Yeah. What's your next book, Dennis?
Well, The Fin Whale that Jill mentioned in Wellfleet brings me to my next book. By the way, my colleague on the Dolphin Fleet, John Conlon, is an expert on fin whales, and I've learned a lot from him about fin whales. And he has a couple books out, but they're not in print, I don't think. One called Razorback, which is another name for a fin whale. But this is a book that I got at the New Bedford Museum, Cape Cod Shore Whaling, America's First Whaleman, by John Braggington Smith and Duncan Oliver. It's full of information, put it that way. I don't think it's so artfully written, but if you are interested in the history of Cape Cod, it is just shocking. First of all, they were called drift. We have to go back to a time when whales were so abundant that that dead whales were, there were so many live whales that it was a very common occurrence for there to be dead whales. Mm-hmm. And the Native Americans had been harvesting them for years. So when the early settlers got here, they would find a whale on the beach and utilize it. After a while, they got in boats and went up and down the coast looking for drift whales. And I guess finally they got the idea, well, there's one that's not quite dead yet. Let's bring it along. And that's really how whaling began. But American whaling really began at Sag Harbor, Long Island. But they came up and taught Cape Codders. They, in turn, taught the people on Nantucket and so on. But there's so much shocking information here. These people were so good. Human beings are so good at devastating things. Whales were becoming scarce on Cape Cod by 1715.
Wow, who knew that?
Wood was becoming scarce because, remember, they were trying the blubber with fires. Mm-hmm. They were also building, they had coopers who were building the casks, the wooden barrels. Very, very important that they be good quality. Somewhere I have it, Wellfleet's Great Island, by 1711, devoid of wood. Hmm. No wood at all. In 1714, the General Court created province lands. 1714 regulated the taking of wood because of erosion. 1714. So these early people had a great impact, not only on the whales.
But life on land, yeah. Absolutely.
Life on land.
You needed wood back then.
Yeah, so if you're interested in the history of Cape Cod, I think this book is very, very important.
Cape Cod Shore Whaling, yeah. America's First Whaleman.
Okay. And he says in here, virtually every man was involved in some aspect of whaling. Virtually every man, part of the year, all of the year, whatever. And this is before they went offshore. This is all shore whaling.
Yeah. Wow. So. Okay. Thanks, Dennis. Jill?
Well, along those lines, I brought along a book called Living with Whales, Documents and Oral Histories of Native New England Whaling History, edited by Nancy Shoemaker and put together by the University of Massachusetts Press, published by them. And it's a volume in a series called Native Americans of the Northeast. And in this book, she tries to reconstruct the history of Native whaling in New England through a bunch of primary documents, explores descriptions of their first encounters, indentures, deeds, merchants' accounts, Indian overseer reports, crew lists, memoirs, obituaries. And one of the most interesting sections of the book are her interviews that she does, these oral histories with the Wampanoag. And Ramona Peters, as it turns out, is got a big... oral history in here, and it was she was the reason, apparently, that this author decided to start doing the book. In her preface, she says, I consider these last two chapters, which are the Wampanoag oral histories, the most important and most interesting part of the book. Indeed, the idea for this book originated from a conversation I had several years ago with Ramona Peters, who had many great stories and objects that had passed down in her family, as well as an extensive knowledge of New England Native history based on years of research. After that conversation, I could not envision a book about this history without her and other descendants represented in it. So it's a very interesting read, and this first oral history is Ramona Peters, and she meets her in the office at Mashpee on Cape Cod in May 2011. And she says, we had met the year before when we learned of our shared interest in Wampanoag whaling history, and it was her knowledge and stories that prompted me to put together this book. And then there are other oral histories as well. So a very interesting look at how the history of whaling started well before, you know, Moby Dick. Mm-hmm. In other words, there was a lot going on before things happened on Nantucket. So it's the legacy of the emotions of whaling for the people that were left behind and a lot of the artifacts that they still have that are part of their family collections. So a very interesting collection of documents, and not a sit down and read all the way through kind of book, but certainly a book to sit down and think about the history of whaling in this area. It's called Living with Whales, Documents and Oral Histories of Native New England Whaling History, edited by Nancy Shoemaker.
Okay. Dennis.
Yeah, that reminds me that in the last book I talked about, Cape Cod Shore Whaling, almost every boat had a Native American in it. They were paid, if they were paid at all, at a different scale. Mm. And there were also indentured servants back then in the good old days. So... it wasn't quite a democratic enterprise. My next book is a book that Philip Hoare recommended to me. It's called Whale by Joe Roman. I got to hear Joe Roman talk at our latest seminar that we have every year for whale people. And this is a series, animal series. There's one crow, tortoise, cockroach, ant, pig. This one is whale by Joe Roman. He's, I think, at the University of Vermont. And it's just full of facts. I will just read to you a little bit about baleen or whalebone was found in every corner of the home. Skirt hoops, tongue scrapers, whatever that is. Shoehorns, fishing rods, divining rods, canes, and riding whips. The finer fringes were used in brooms and flue brushes. Blubber may have lit the world, but the most significant baleen product was usually kept in the dark. The whalebone corset was designed to give fashionable women the smallest waist possible. Catherine de' Medici, Queen of France, declared the ideal waist size to be 13 inches.
Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, they're
passing out all the time. So I'm going to hold... This is terrible. I'm holding this up to the mic. It's a picture of various corsets. The lower left-hand one designed for a child between 1 and 2 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
Says here that... Whalebone was not only a source of pain for women, it was also used to discipline wild school children. When a child was struck with a whalebone whip, he got a whaling.
Oh.
Whaling. Mm. In Uncle Tom's Cabin, how'd you like your whaling? Right. So on and so forth. So, whalebone. But it went from $5 a pound in 1850 to 50 cents a pound by 1890 or so when... can't find that reference now, but steel was, well, right. When corsets went out of fashion, right. We would all
thank goodness.
Yeah. And they found spring steel, which was introduced in 1907, quickly replacing baleen as a more flexible and cheaper material. And of course, 1865 is when they hit oil in Titusville, mm-hmm. Pennsylvania, so that was sort of the end of oil. Mm-hmm. However,
end of whaling, you mean, yeah.
Not the end of whaling, because as Bob Rocha at the New Bedford Whaling Museum points out in a beautiful paper, there were more whales killed, in the 3 million whales killed in the 20th century before the moratorium. More whales killed in 1 year than in all the 19th century.
Is that right?
So, and a lot of whale products in the 20th century, margarine,
right.
Glycerin, other things. Right. Anyhow, there's a lot of good information in whale. It's very well written, too.
Okay, Jill.
Well, I thought I'd bring some lighter reading than Moby Dick along with me. And what with summer approaching, I have two really good summer reading titles for you that want to just sit on the beach and not think too hard about your whales, but yet think about whales. And one of them is a thriller by a guy named David Poyer, who I had not heard of, but apparently has written tons of books about thrillers. And he is connected to the U.S. Naval Academy. So therefore, he's got a lot of good science behind what he writes about. And this one is called The Whiteness of the Whale. Hmm. And it's basically a thriller that takes fans, as it says in the Kirkus Review, on a frightening ride that will have them reaching for their Dramamine. The primate behavioralist, Dr. Sarah Pollard, joins a small crew on the sailboat Black Anemone that plans to disrupt Japanese whaling in the Antarctic seas. And as it happens, there's a Nantucket connection, of course, because Dr. Sarah Pollard's career as a primate behavioralist lies in ruins. However, she is a descendant of a Nantucket captain whose ship was sunk by a rogue whale. And so she accepts to join this group who's going to be the anti-whaling activists who are going around the world racing in order to stop the Japanese whaling fleet, apparently, is what's going on here. And he does a great job of describing the sea and the ice. He spent a lot of time on the ocean, and you can certainly see that in here. It talks about there's a little passage here about imagining a creature that hunted in complete darkness half a mile under the sea, mm-hmm. a world of sound, not sight, of crushing pressure and utter cold. No one knew much about whale social behavior, which made sense. You could observe chimps and bonobos in the wild, house them in a habitat and test them. But a creature that came to the surface for a breath only once an hour, that spent most of its time where only a submarine could follow, about all you could do was kill them and weigh them. And so that is the David Poyer, The Whiteness of the Whale. And if you want complete silliness, you can go to Christopher Moore's novel, The Fluke, or I Know Why the Winged Whale Sings. It's about whales, but as it says in the review, its approach to marine biology is more zonked out than scientific. To Mr. Moore, quote, a long series of whoops that sounded like an ambulance driving through pudding describes a whale song. And, quote, scientists do know that it tends to be found in the New Age music section as well as in tropical waters, end quote. It's a very silly book, but it has a very serious point, which is he is trying to help people save whales. And so if you like silliness, this is a great book. If you like whales, this is great. It's Christopher Moore, Fluke, or I Know Why the Winged Whale Sings.
I've got 45 seconds, Dennis. Can you talk about your last book in 45 seconds?
I was just going to say, the Whiteness of the Whale is a chapter in Moby Dick, and he talks about how scary the color white is. Yeah. I said no science, but the cultural lives of whales and dolphins The principal author is Hal Whitehead. Scary, scary, scary how sophisticated whales are and what they actually have culture. It's not an easy read, but it's an important read if you're interested in whales.
All right. Dennis Minsky, field biologist, naturalist, and marine educator aboard the Dolphin Fleet Whale Watch, and Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll have a list to our books later today on our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.